Welcome back, I'm Erin. A few quick updates. First, last month a petition was submitted in New Hampshire for the historical marker. And now the Murrays are asking for your help in urging the Division of Historical Resources to approve the application. If you want to help in that effort, you can go to their website at moremurraymissing.org/call-to-action and find ways to contact the Historical Resources staff. Second, we're still waiting on the ruling from the Superior Court judge on whether or not the accident scene photos will be released. But that should be coming, hopefully within the next several days or weeks. Finally, my guest in the next few episodes is Jenny Decker, who is an author and podcaster that recently began looking more closely at the case. But she'll actually be the one asking me some questions about some of the things that she's come across during her research that she wanted more clarification about. You can check out Jenny's website at downandawaypodcast.com and follow her on Twitter at @downandawaypod. And here's the first part of the Q&A with Jenny.
Okay, so first of all, I want to thank you for doing this, because when I reached out to ask you to do it, I know it's a weird request for one podcaster to, you know, ask to interview another one, but you were a good sport and you said you'd do it. So I want to thank you for that right off the top.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
So I want to go back, if we can, to all the way back to when you attended UMass. And I want to know if you have independent recollection of learning about Maura going missing. Do you remember that? You know, what was going on around that time? Do you remember it at all, or only in hindsight?
Yeah, I do remember. My first memory was hearing Kate Markopoulos talk to our track coach. And I remember our track coach was asking some questions like what happened the weekend before, because they were trying to figure out where Maura was. She was supposed to come back for spring track that Monday, I guess. And she didn't. And then there was this report that her car had been found and they didn't really know what was going on. And so I remember that conversation, and I don't think I really put it together that it was like who it was or what the significance was until later when it was in the newspaper. But that was my only real lasting memory.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere in one of the articles that there was an email that went out that the school sent to all the students to sort of find out maybe if she was, you know, had fallen asleep or was in someone else's room or something at someone else's dorm. Do you remember getting that email?
Yeah, there was an email that went out. I don't remember getting it. I'm sure that I did, but it might have been one of those things that it was just like went out to the entire university, so I didn't necessarily read it or pay attention. But,
right, things that you just sort of click off and delete.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Huh. So it wasn't like immediately the day that they, you know, she was missing, everybody at UMass was crazy and looking all over for her then. It doesn't seem like it took a little bit of time to filter, put this stuff together, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of confusion at first, because you had the police sort of saying, telling her family that, well, we think she might have been suicidal. And so that didn't seem to jive with, I think, what Kate's experience was. And so it was just a big puzzle.
Yeah.
Like everyone was sort of bewildered.
Right.
About what could have happened.
That makes sense to me. It's what it sounds like. So as far as Kate, I think I read somewhere that she was your big sister. Was that like just related to track or school altogether? I don't really know about this big sister thing. So I wondered if every underclassman had one, or, and what was that role that she had with you?
So every underclassman on the track team was assigned a big sister. It was basically like a mentor that you could go to if you had any kind of question about how things worked or how the travel schedule worked or how to get your per diem for when you travel, like just any question you had. It was just a person that you could go to that wasn't the coach necessarily, that was there to help guide you.
Gotcha. I was really sure what the big sister thing was, so I wanted to figure, you know, kind of understand what that was. So then I guess fast forward a little bit, when did you first jump into actually researching Maura's case?
It wasn't until like 2015, and I hadn't really ever had any interest in true crime or podcasts or anything like that, but I did listen to the Serial podcast, and I really liked that. And I remember one of the like recommended podcast came up and it was Missing Maura Murray. And I thought to myself, I knew Maura Murray. Like, what is this all about?
And so I started listening to it and was really surprised at how much I didn't know at the time, and that there was like this huge community out there that I was completely unaware of. And so I started, like a lot of people do in this case, sort of just dive in, find out, you know, what's written on the internet, all that, and going down the rabbit holes, and eventually started a blog of my own. But that's how I sort of got introduced to it.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me, because the first case that I got really interested in was exactly sort of the same thing, although I didn't have a personal connection. I lived in the town where it occurred, and I was researching something else, and I happened upon it. And so I get that, like all of a sudden you go to read one topics thread, and then all of a sudden it's days and then weeks, and then, you know, so that totally feels familiar to me. Yeah. So tell me how you met Julie Murray.
I met Julie at the, I guess it would have been the 13-year anniversary gathering. It wasn't really a vigil. It was a gathering at, I think, the VFW in, I think, Littleton, New Hampshire. And I'd heard that they were going to be doing that. And John Smith was going to be there. I think Tim and Lance were there. And so it was on a Saturday. And I decided, well, I'll drive up after work on Friday from DC, because it was my grandfather's birthday later that week, and I was planning to drive up anyway to New England. So I drove up on a Friday, and I almost actually missed the entire thing because there was like a pretty huge blizzard on the drive up, and I ended up having to drive like all night, going up 91, like 15 miles an hour.
Oh my gosh.
And so I almost skipped it entirely, but I decided to go for like the last half an hour, and I'm glad I did, because like the one thing I got to do was meet Julie, and she gave me her email address and we talked for a little while. So, but that was the first time I'd ever seen or met Julie, Fred, and the rest of the family that was there.
Huh, that's neat. See, I didn't know any of this, so I'm really glad that I've been able to, you know, to do this, because there's a lot. Every person you talk to has another sort of perspective of how they got into it and what they, you know, where their eyes are focused. And so it's interesting. I can't imagine, first of all, driving, you know, you must have been panicked driving through a snowstorm. I've done that before. I used to live in Michigan, so that would have been enough to really throw my anxiety off. But
yeah,
I'm glad you got there, and it's really good, sort of serendipitous, that you were able to meet Julie at that time. And I wanted to ask you, since we're talking about Julie real quick, there was a tweet this week that someone had asked me directly to see if I can find out about. And so I had you ahead of time reach out to Julie. And so basically it read this way. It says, "There's a nice nugget in the book that has the author accosting Julie at her apartment. He asks her why Mara was traveling, and she answers, quote, 'I know exactly why she was going up there,' before her partner intervened and told her not to say anything else. Was he making it up?"
Well, I can't speak to necessarily whether he was making it up or not, but I did ask Julie about that, and her recollection is that she thought that the author was asking her about why her father was at UMass with $4,000. And so her response was, "I know exactly why he was going there." And that's all that she really said to him. So whether or not he sort of misconstrued that or deliberately obfuscated the facts, I don't know. But to be clear, like, she's been on True Crime Garage. She did an interview with them. I mean, she said many times, including in that interview, that she had no idea why Mara was in New Hampshire, where she was going, why she left UMass. So the point is that she doesn't know.
Okay, so it sounds like the question that she thought she was asked at that time was, why was your father up there with $4,000?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so she was answering that question. All right, that makes sense. All right, and maybe he misunderstood her. I can give them, you know, him the benefit of the doubt there, because that makes sense to me, because he's been asked that. People have been asked that about Fred and the $4,000. Okay, so speaking of Fred, how did you get the interview with him? That was a good interview, by the way. I enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you. So that, it was actually kind of funny, because I had been up in Maine and driving back to DC and got a text from Julie, and she asked if I could talk later, and I said yes, of course. And I decided to stop in Haverhill because there were some things I wanted to do at the police station. And Ethan, my co-host, met me there. He had been at a bachelor party in I think, Connecticut. So we actually met in Haverhill, and then I called Julie, and that's when she asked me, it was via text, I think. She asked me if I wanted to interview Fred. And, of course, I said, absolutely, yes. Yeah. But they actually reached out to me.
That's fantastic. So was it, like, your first big interview of someone that was important and related to this case?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was my first interview, period. I'd never interviewed anyone before.
Really?
And so it was quite one to start with. Yeah, yep. So I think I'd only had maybe 5 episodes or so with the podcast by then.
Huh.
4 or 5.
Well, that's great. It was a good interview, and I actually just re-listened to it a while back. That's great. I didn't realize that it was your first interview. I would have been nervous beyond belief. What did you make of Fred as a person? What were your feelings about him?
Just to go back to the nerves for a second, I was so nervous. I mean, I used a little like blue microphone, Snowball, and I didn't really know if that was like the proper what I should be using, and so one of the things I did was buy like every kind of microphone you can imagine, like everyone that was available, like condenser, shotgun, Omni, and set them all up. So there were like microphones recording from 5 different ports. And I still recorded on my phone just in case. Yeah, no, I wish I had taken a picture. There were wires like everywhere, like all over the table. It was ridiculous.
Oh my gosh.
But I was so nervous that I would not get something or, you know.
That's fun. Yes, I know. Anything. Yeah, but I've never done that much. I mean, 2 things going at once. Yeah, but bless your heart. That's actually a really good story. That makes me laugh because we've all been there when you want to really do a good job with an interview and you're eager and you're overexcited. My big thing is I always talk way too fast.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I've actually had a cop tell me once when I was calling in and letting him know I had gotten a couple tips, and I called him and he said, I don't know if you know this, but you speak really fast and I'm trying to take notes. So I can relate to that. I was so, embarrassed. I still do it. We're eager. We're interested in what they have to say. And so it's, I can relate to that. So let's see. When was the first time that you contacted Bill? What was that interaction like? Bill Rausch.
Well, the first time I contacted him was not the first time I spoke to him because it's actually kind of a weird story. I was flying from Atlanta to DC, and it was like early 2017, and I was boarding the plane, and I heard like whispers. People were saying like, "Is that Jesse Jackson?" Like the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And so I turn around, and I'm like, "Is that Bill Rausch?" And they're like, "Who's Bill Rausch?" And so I was convinced that it was him, though. I was pretty sure. And so I'm trying to like Google it on my phone to get his picture. And they ended up sitting in front of me, Jesse Jackson and Bill Rausch. And I had to like think the entire time, like, do I say anything? I have a blog about his missing girlfriend. Like, how do I introduce myself without completely freaking him out? And I decided not to, because I didn't want to make him uncomfortable and me uncomfortable. And but then I got home later and I was like, well, I might as well email him. There's no better time or better reason, I guess. And so I emailed him and I said, hey, I think you were on my flight. I think you're sitting next to Jesse Jackson, but and didn't expect him to respond, and he didn't. Then later, like a few years later, when we actually met, he didn't realize that it was me that had sent him that email. And he was just talking about, some of the crazy obsessed people that contact him. And he's like, I got this one email once about some girl like saw me on a flight. And then she sent an email to me. And it was because of that that I ended up getting a security system. He's like, I didn't know, like, did this person follow me home? And I'm like, Bill, I have to tell you something. That was me.
Oh, that's funny. Huh. That's really neat. I mean, I would have been excited to see Jesse Jackson alone, but both of them, that's interesting. By the way, I've done the same thing. I would not have, nudged him and said, hey, by the way, because I'm always worried about making someone else uncomfortable. And so I would not have done that either.
Right, right. Until you realize the alternative is like, I saw you on a plane. You didn't see me. I saw you.
That's true. That like, doesn't sound any better.
Yeah. In retrospect, probably not the most normal thing to do. Yeah. But it seems appropriate at the time.
Right, you know? Right. Okay, so there was another thing I read about that I wanted to ask you about. Tell me about the accusation of defamation against you. It was in a blog post, and how that relates to a Haverhill local who got a call from someone pretending to be a lawyer trying to convince him to sue you. What in the heck is this about?
So the background of that is that there is a Haverhill local that's been looked at in Mara's case, and there's a decent amount of information to suggest that they really did look at him seriously. I know that when he moved in 2009, he lived pretty close to the crash scene. The police were there with cadaver dogs searching like right after he sold his house. And so they seem to take him seriously as a potential suspect. He's also put out some videos that sort of hint at the idea that Moore may have come up to his door that night. And he's made other suggestions that that he may have seen her after the accident, a couple miles down the road running. Mm-hmm. So his name's been out there for a while. And I ended up interviewing a guy named Guy Parody, who he was a part of the New Hampshire League of Investigators, which is a group of volunteer former law enforcement that they just volunteer on different cases and offer their expertise. They have no affiliation with the Murrays. They do this sort of like separate on their own. And I wanted to hear what he had to say because I knew that that was their suspects. And from what I had heard from some of the police in New Hampshire, that was also, this local was their suspect. So I thought even if, you know, the information wasn't convincing to me, at least it should be out there. So after that, a blogger was rather displeased with the interview because he thought that this local's name was being dragged through the mud, and he was concerned that I had defamed him. And so he called him up and called up his ex-wife pretending to be a lawyer and tried to get them, convince them to sue me for defamation. This is just to add, like, despite the fact that this guy, this local, had been approached by the Oxygen Channel and then he declined to talk to them. They subsequently got in a car and followed him on the highway like 90 miles an hour before accosting him in Home Depot parking lot on camera, making pretty accusatory statements. And then that was put on national television as like a promo for the disappearance of Maura Murray. And Tim and Lance had also interviewed Guy Parody. But for whatever reason, he picked me to say that I committed defamation. Not any of those other people, but me.
Mm.
Going so far as to pretending to be a lawyer so that, you know, he could convince these people that they could get a lot of money if they would just sue me.
Yeah, the part about pretending to be a lawyer is troubling. That is concerning to me. That's a red flag, and that's all I'll say about that. But that's, you know, that's another level of strangeness, I would say.
And I'll just add one other thing about that. The reason I even know about that he did that was because somebody that had been working with law enforcement on trying to get his ex-wife to sort of open up and start talking more, she told me that they were really frustrated by it because she had just started to talk to them and offer some more information, and suddenly she's getting these phone calls and is very confused about what's happening and why is this guy calling. So that's how I ended up learning about it.
Yeah, and from a law enforcement perspective, that is literally inserting yourself into an investigation, and that can cause problems. You know, mm-hmm. when you're scaring witnesses like that, yeah, that's problematic. Okay, so let's see. I'm looking at my list here. I want to get into some specifics now about Maura's case, things that, you know, sort of floated to the surface when I was researching and wanted to, you know, see if you know more about it or if we can do some clarification. The first thing is, so there's some speculation out there that Maura might have left Sarah's dorm party with a guy And we've got about an hour of unaccounted for time between the time that allegedly she left at around 2:30 and then when she got in the accident sometime around 3:30 in her father's car. Mm-hmm. So first, what do we know about this person that she may have left with, if anything?
So all we really know about the party is that there were three guys there that didn't go to UMass. One of them was Sarah Alfieri's cousin. The other two, we don't know anything about them other than the fact that they weren't students at UMass, supposedly. And there is some information to suggest that Maura may have left with one of them for some amount of time. I don't know if it was during the party or at the end, but that she did leave with this person for some amount of time. But other than that, we really don't know anything about these guys.
Oh, and we don't even know, like you said, I didn't realize that, when during that party, if she left with him, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Whether it was in the middle and they came back.
Yeah, because I think the 2:30 time, I think that comes from Kate.
Yeah, and I do remember one article saying that Sarah was sleeping, that Kate had said Sarah was asleep when Maura left. So that's the only thing that I remembered reading, whether that's accurate or not. That's the problem when we're going, you know, just by newspaper articles. You know, we don't have the context of the conversation and we only have these little blurbs here and there. So we're kind of speculating on top of speculating. But do we know what Fred has been told about this person, if he has been told anything?
That's all he's been told. Supposedly the police do know who these people are, but they have not told Mr. Murray who they are. So all he knows is what Kate told him, which is that one of them was Sarah's cousin.
Now, I need to set this up in my head here. Sarah's dorm, was it close to Maura's dorm? Are they in the same building?
It wasn't the same building, but it was the same residential area. So it was pretty close, like 3-minute walk at most.
Oh, all right. So if she did leave with someone, they could have gone back to her dorm. Did you have to sign in, do you remember, when you're going at night to in and out of dorms like that?
You did. If she had left after 2:30, then she probably would not have had to sign anyone in because the shifts on the weekends were from 8 p.m. to 3 technically, but generally you'd start like packing up the phone and packing up the sign-in book and all that stuff about a half an hour before your shift was over. So it's possible that he was signed in. It's also possible he wasn't because it was sort of if she did leave around 2:30, like it would have been right on that line.
Well, what about the three guys? Let's say those three guys were up in Sarah's dorm. Would they have had to sign in? Because it was earlier than that 3:30 time period when they got over there, right?
Yeah, so if they arrived after 8 p.m., then yes, they would have had to sign in. If they got there before, like if they had stayed with Sarah and they entered the dorm, you know, 7 o'clock or any time before 8 p.m., then they would not have had to sign in unless they left the building and came back. But that's a good question. I haven't heard that that question before about whether they would have had to sign in. Presumably, that would be a good place to look.
And I would guess that those records probably don't exist now, although I would hope that the police have that's what they went and checked. You know, I don't know.
They might actually exist only because I actually had the same security job as Maura, which was signing people in the dorms. And there was always a list of people on the like do not enter list in the back of the book.
Oh.
And they ended up being used in some occasions in like criminal cases years later. So especially restraining orders or no contact orders, stuff like that. So it's possible those actually still exist. We're getting a little far away. It's now 16 years, but it is possible.
Well, then there's something to put on the list to check into anyway. I mean, okay, good. So there's something. Let's see. All right, so another thing I read was that it was reported that when Fred searched the boxes taken from Maura's dorm, he discovered documents showing that Maura had been applying for server or bartender positions at brew pubs near Hanson, 2 hours from UMass. I assume this means employment applications. Is that what they were?
So I asked Fred about that. He actually doesn't recall any applications in those boxes. It's not to say that they weren't there, but he said if they were there, if there were applications, it was probably for summer bartending jobs.
That was my next question. You know, if she did, in fact, have applications, it seems like how many months is your summer break between semesters?
It's about three months. And then there's also the winter break at UMass is really long too. It's like at least 6 weeks generally. So it's possible she was looking for like a winter job during that break. But yeah, but the summer, it would June, July, August, it was at least 3 months of time.
Yeah, and that makes sense because I imagine there are some places that will hire students and know that, okay, she'll only be here to work for during the break periods and that's it. But we don't even have any idea if those, in fact, existed when she picked those applications up, right? We don't have any information about it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it would have been at least before she had returned to school.
Yeah.
So I think if there's any suggestion that she was looking for jobs in Hanson, like then, like to move home or leave school or something, I don't think that makes a ton of sense because she didn't go back to Hanson that I'm aware of after she arrived for the second semester.
Okay. That one's kind of a tough one then. She could have, they could have been there for a year for all we know.
Right. Exactly.
All right. I just thought I would ask because I wasn't quite clear on that. And I didn't even know where the information came from. I just read it somewhere on Reddit or something. So I didn't even know where that information originated from. Okay, let's talk about that Red Cross call for a minute, because I was listening to a recent podcast and there were questions about, first, whether Fred or Kathleen or any other of the Murray family members had ever heard that call.
So, yes, Fred had heard that call. Bill played it for him in the Wells River Motel. And from his perspective, all he could hear was like static. He didn't hear what I think Bill may have heard, which is, I think, some soft sobbing. Mm-hmm. He couldn't really make that out. Like, to him, it was just static.
Right. And I think the police said the same thing, right? That it was just static that they heard?
They did. Yeah, exactly. So the police also played it over their landline a number of times. And to them, they also couldn't really make anything out. They assumed it was just static as well.
All right. So we know they listened to it. They heard it. They had an opportunity. If they needed to take it, they would have a copy of it, I assume. Do we know for sure if they ever got a copy of it?
I would suspect they did because they did play it through their landline. I can't say for sure whether that exists, but they did trace the call. They tend to be very vague often, but one thing that they have said in no uncertain terms is that the call did come from the Red Cross.
Right.
So I think that there was some confusion and still maybe some confusion because I know that Sharon went and tried to reach out to the person at the Red Cross who would have made those calls. And when she spoke to them, they had no recollection of ever calling Bill. And generally, it's the spouse or the parent who's contacted by the Red Cross and the commanding officer. They don't usually speak directly to the soldiers. And so that's where I think they weren't necessarily convinced that it was the Red Cross, because she had actually spoken to somebody there that said, no, we don't have any memory of ever calling him.
And, you know, you wonder how many calls they have to do. You know, would they remember if mm-hmm. someone asked? You know, I mean, would they? That's, I guess, where the confusion comes in. But, you know, one thing I wanted to point out is that, you know, when I was listening to that podcast, they seemed to make a big deal out of the fact that Bill might have heard something and his mom repeated what Bill had heard, the shivering or whimpering or possible labored breathing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've gotten butt dial calls before. I know what that's like when you get a call and it's an open line and you're hearing things and you don't know what it is. Now put yourself in a position where someone that you love has just gone missing and you get a call and nobody's talking on it. Mm-hmm. The line's open and you're hearing whatever, static, what it sounds like, whimpering. I think it's reasonable to assume that someone might read things into that, you know, that static, that sound.
Yeah.
That's very normal, you know. So I don't understand the questions about that, because to me that's normal. In fact, I was doing some research yesterday about cases that involve some of these calls, and the one that I had remembered seeing on an episode was the one of Faith Hedgepeth. There was a pocket dial call in that case, and the contents of it were sort of garbled sounds, and they were different though depending on who you asked. Her family thought that they had heard screaming, or they thought maybe she was begging for her life, but then police were able to trace that call to the time that she was at the bar and not later at her apartment when they know she was killed. So basically what had happened is the parents had, you know, sort of read into what they thought they were hearing on it. And it was really stuff happening at a bar. And so you know, the human mind has a tendency to make these connections when they're not there, when we've got certain information on board and we don't have other information. So I just wanted to point that out because, you know, in the podcast, yeah, there was they were speculating and making it sound, you know, there was even this mention of Sharon was hyperbolic in her description of it. And I thought, you know, she's repeating what her son said, for goodness sakes. What do you want from her?
Right.
You know? And so I kind of thought that was unfair. And I wanted to mention that because, you know, I can totally, having gotten butt dials before that were lasted minutes long, you know, wondering from my husband, what the heck's going on? You know, what's happening? And you don't know what's going on. So, you know, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And I think he's even said that. Someone described it pretty well, I think. You know, those like ghost recorders that electronically record audio, and like most people, they just hear static, but some people are convinced that they're listening to a ghost and they're hearing voices. I kind of feel like it's like that phenomenon.
Yeah, I've seen some of those shows that do those, and I'm never really impressed with that. I don't get what they're hearing, but, you know, I mean, there are people that do, so, you know, everybody has their own experience, and, you know, everybody perceives things based on that experience and their own biases, and that's how we take in information. That's how the brain works. Okay, right. So let's see. Let me go down to the next one. All right, was there only one person who interviewed Haas?
As far as I know, yes. I think that the Oxygen show reached out to him, and obviously he either said no or didn't respond. But as far as I know, only one person has ever talked to Haas, besides, of course, law enforcement.
Right. And so in blog posts and in the book about that interview, the author reported that friends had suggested they should begin dating. Do we even know who these friends are?
I believe that the source for that was a member of the track team who was interested in setting them up, like, quote, setting them up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that she ever said that they had been set up and that they were dating. I think dating might be a little bit strong of a word, of a term to use. But that's where that came from.
Got it.
And just to say that when you mentioned the interview that was conducted with him, I believe it was just like a 5-minute phone call. I think that was the extent of the, quote, interview.
And the reason why I bring this up is because it seems like later, when all this information came about and people started speculating about the UMass cabin, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the speculation around the UMass cabin was that Mara may have known about it through Haas, because they learned, had known about it. Unfortunately, the author was not able to get back in touch with Haas and, you know, follow up with him and ask him a simple question. Did you ever tell Mara about the UMass cabin? If that relationship between interviewer and interviewee was a good relationship, I would think that he would have been able to ask him that follow-up question. It's a very simple question, and then we could have knocked that one right off our list. Unfortunately, we're stuck there.
Right.
And so we can't ask him. And the reason why I bring that up is only because I've done a lot of interviews over, you know, the course of writing some books and a podcast, and I have never once had someone I interviewed refuse to do a follow-up with me, ever. In fact, much of the time, they will contact me back and say, oh, and sometimes it's days later or even months later. It just happened this week. Oh, I just remembered something, you know, I remembered something that you had asked me about, or I didn't, you know, I asked my husband about this and he, you know, and filled in this blank here or there. So that stood out to me as we only have one person that talked to Haas, and that person was never able to follow up and ask a very simple follow-up question. To me, that's a red flag. That's concerning, because I wonder what made him not want to follow, you know, to take that, because the author did say he followed up and tried to, you know, email him and he hadn't gotten back with him. So that was concerning to me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree.
I would like to, since we're talking about Haas real quick, I had found a couple open letters from Fred Murray to the author, and he addressed this very specifically because in the blog, the author had said that Haas had told him, I believe, that he never even knew Mara had a father, or that he was alive or existed. Is that right? That he didn't even know?
That's correct.
All right. Well,
yeah.
From Fred Murray's letter, it says, Hossein something said that he never knew Mora's father was alive when he met Mara and me while we were watching a race, and he told me of his prospective book about a runner. So Fred Murray says they did meet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. And I didn't even know that. And that wasn't widely out there because I wasn't even aware of these until I stumbled across them. So I think it's important that people know that Fred disputes that he did meet Haas because, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes he doesn't. People are saying this or that about Fred, but he's specifically disputing the fact that they had never met.
Right. And I can't remember exactly how it was worded in the book. I think that he said something like, she never spoke about her father. For all he knew, he wasn't alive anymore, which was,
yeah.
I mean, you can sort of see how something could be contrived with those statements. The fact that she didn't necessarily speak about him to Haas doesn't mean that he's not alive. Like, that's kind of a huge, huge leap.
It's a big leap. And they didn't date for very long either. It was like, you know, the way it was worded was that she visited him over one summer. And then by the time they were back in school again, she wasn't, you know, she had told him she had already gotten back with Bill.
Yeah.
So it was a very, you know, a very short amount of time based on what the author says on the blog.
Right.
So we don't know what they discussed or what they didn't discuss just because she didn't mention anything about her dad, you know, doesn't mean, you know, anything really.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I guess while we're talking about that, one of the false claims out there is that she was having this affair, quote, affair with Haas. And that's just 100% false because she had broken up with Bill. They had been broken up at the time. And even in the book, Haas is quoted as saying, I got this random email about her boyfriend. They had started things back up. She left whatever we had. So obviously, like, the implication is that they had been off, like her and Bill had been off. They weren't together at the time.
Right.
So that is one thing that I still hear over and over again, this affair, but it was not an affair.
Right. She was not dating Bill at the time. She was dating someone else or seeing right. whoever. She could have been gone out with other guys too. We don't know. But she wasn't dating mm-hmm. him. So the word affair, the use of the word affair is incorrect because I take your point there. I didn't even think of that, but you're right. It's not, you know, words matter and we need to be using them appropriately, especially when we're talking about a murder investigation and not, you know, use words that are, you know, emotionally inflammatory as opposed to being factually accurate. Okay.
Right. And one other thing, sorry to.
No, no, go
this,
ahead.
But,
go ahead.
But I, from what I remember in the book, one of the reasons that he even came up was because the captain of the track team said that she was trying to set Maura up. Like, that's at least according to the book, quote, set her up with Haas. So the idea that it was also not just an affair, but like an illicit relationship that they shouldn't have been having. I mean, the captain of the track team was the one trying to set them up.
Right. So obviously they knew. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And while I don't think that the coaches would have loved the idea and they probably, you know, would frown upon it, it in no way violated any kind of university policy.
Right.
So that's important too, I think, because it's been overblown. And I really just, I don't think that it was a huge deal.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that have been overblown in this case. That's kind of the problem when you're starting with speculation and you don't have a lot of the facts, is that we're all banging mm-hmm. over and over at these same, you know, 12 topics because this is all we have.
Yeah.
And so then it just gets distorted and it becomes, you know, it's like a game of telephone.
Yeah. A sensational game of telephone.
A very sensational. I agree. Sort of related to that, there was apparently a printed email that was early on characterized as a note left in Maura's dorm room with her belongings. There's still some dispute as to whether she had packed up prior to leaving UMass or was still not unpacked after the holiday break. But I want to talk about that email. What do you know about it?
So from what I know, it was an email that Bill had sent to Maura 2 years before. And I know that it was reported that it was on her bed, like laid out on her bed, and that was interpreted as some sort of like cryptic message that she was sending. But actually, it was tucked into a basketball program in a box that was either on her bed or in her desk. And it's hard to say like how that got misconstrued. My best guess is that the police were taking photographs, the UMass police, for the New Hampshire State Police. And maybe they took it out and took a picture, and Lieutenant Scorinza, who was the one that put out the information that there was this note laid out on her bed. Maybe he saw that picture and just assumed that that's where it was, like that's where it was located. But that's not accurate. It was actually tucked inside a basketball program. And the content of it, from what I understand, had to do with an incident at West Point a few years before where Bill ended up cheating on Maura. And so that's what it was.
Where's your source for, how did you learn that it was tucked into the basketball program?
That came from Bill. So he's the one that actually went to UMass. I think it was that Friday after she disappeared.
Okay.
With Rob McDonald. And they were looking for, you know, just any kind of sign that would point in some direction as to like where she was going, why she left. And they couldn't find anything, but he ended up finding that email that was tucked into the basketball program.
Okay, gotcha. So that makes sense. And I had reached out and asked him just briefly about that too. And he had said, you know, when him and Rob first went in there, their impression was that she was packed. But he feels like mm-hmm. there's a possibility that he got that impression because law enforcement told him she was packed. You know what I mean? It's hard to say these many years later when someone's asking you these questions, you know, what you knew at what time you knew it, because it's all happening to you very quickly, especially when it's, you know, your loved one and you're just taking in all this information and you're not quite, you know, certain. And then you've got police saying, well, oh, she walked off from a DUI or it was suicide or whatever. When they're saying something to you, you're taking that in because it's a police officer. And even though you have specific information in your head going, well, I don't know that she'd ever do that. They're telling you this. So you're considering it, you know? So if they had said, well, her, you know, she packed up a room. Well, we don't know. Did she pack up a room or was it still left packed? Were you able to, you had mentioned something about a jacket. Were you able to get any confirmation on that from Julie?
Yeah, I personally think that she hadn't yet unpacked, just because I know what the UMass schedule is like and how everything's sort of up in the air before the end of ad drop, and how like you essentially do like pack up your stuff and move home and then move back between the first and second semesters because you can't enter the dorms during the winter session. So to me, it made perfect sense that she hadn't yet unpacked yet, but I understand that. I mean, packed and unpacked, they look exactly the same. It's just like whatever assumptions that you're making about what was going on that determines like the difference if you think it was packed or not yet unpacked. So I don't fault them for coming to that conclusion.
Yeah,
but I think based on what I know about the UMass schedule and Julia told me that she got Maura a jacket for Christmas in South Korea. She'd been stationed in South Korea at the time. And it was out of its packaging, out of the boxes, and hanging in her closet in some of the pictures that were released of her dorm room.
Oh.
And to Julie, that was an indication that she hadn't finished unpacking. Because like some of the stuff like that she had just gotten was hanging up, but not everything. So to her, that was pretty clear indication that she hadn't yet unpacked yet.
Yeah, that does absolutely shine a different light on it. If she knew she gave her that at Christmas and she had just, that's the break they were on. And then now it's mm-hmm. out of the package. It's not still packed in a box or anything. It's hanging up in the closet. I think that's pretty probative. Sure. That makes sense to me. I'm glad you asked her that because that, I think that makes, you know, a difference. Now, whether you're going to still think was packed or, you know, she packed up and just left it, whatever, people are still going to come to their conclusions, but mm-hmm. I think it's a new thing certainly to look at.
Okay. Yeah. I guess the one last thing I would say, sorry.
No, go ahead.
The one last thing about the printed email, because this is one that I should probably just let go, but it does drive me a little nuts.
Yeah.
Is that was put out in a press release 3 or 4 months later, in June of 2004, written by the lead, the lieutenant, Lieutenant Scrinza. And my reading of it is that it was clearly sort of meant to imply that it was a suicide note. I can't really fathom how that could possibly be a suicide note, but I know that Fred and Bill had made a bunch of attempts to contact Lieutenant Scrinza to sort of like set the record straight on that and correct this information about where the note was and what it meant and the fact that there's no way it was a suicide note, and he never responded to them. So unfortunately, that was sort of just one that it just continued to proliferate in the different media stories and never got corrected.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, when you're, I guess when you're an investigator and you all you've got is what's in front of you and you find that sitting there, you know, you may read into it because who knows why she printed it. I mean, it's an odd thing to print, but mm-hmm. we don't know if there was something written on it else that she had scribbled down. You know, who knows what we don't know if it was one sheet of paper. We don't
right.
know. We don't know anything. So it's hard to make any determinations just based on that. I wouldn't look at it as a suicide note either necessarily. So, you know, and the fact is that it was a 2-year-old email about an affair, right, that she had learned about 2 years prior.
Right.
It was very old news. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, I think that they had broken up and gotten back together at least once, maybe twice by that point.
Right.
So it wasn't like a pressing matter.
Yes, and it just made – and she had been seeing someone else in the interim, at least one person that we know of, if mm-hmm. we believe the Haas story. So, you know, they had both seen other people at different times. And so, you know, it kind of sort of one of those muddied the water things that, you know, it may mean nothing. We don't know. You know, it depends on how you take each piece of the information. All right, let's see. So this right here sort of bothered me, and so that's why I wanted to bring it up. There's a lot that's been made about the statement that Fred made when he was asked early on, you know, what might have been going on in his daughter's life that would make her want to leave. And he said, you know, that's not important. She's missing. Find her. And I found an early article. It was dated February 19th, 2004, so that's, what, 10 days after she went missing. And I want to just read from it real quick before I ask the question. So it says, Fred Murray said yesterday that he and his daughter's boyfriend, Bill Rausch of Marengo, Ohio, as well as her friends and siblings, have been trying to figure out if her stress over the first accident would have been enough to cause her to withdraw $280 from her bank account and tell her employers at an art gallery that she'd be away for a week. She was upset because of the accident in my car. She felt she had disappointed me, let me down, like any kid would. I don't think it was anything serious. And so, you know, it mentions everybody sort of not knowing why she was missing and trying mm-hmm. to figure it out. It doesn't, you know, that sort of backs up what Fred is saying. We don't know. We can tell you what we can tell you, but we don't know why she left. And, you know, what's your understanding of why he made that statement? Did you ever talk to him about it?
Yeah. So when I talked to him about it, or I didn't ask about specifically that statement, but when I'd ask about what people's roles were sort of during the search early on, he was pretty clear that like his role was he needed to find her. Like he was 100% focused on New Hampshire, on the town, where she disappeared. Like his focus was to find her. And so unless it was going to help him find her, it wasn't relevant. At least that was my impression. Because he didn't see the connection to what happened to her in New Hampshire, I don't think that he was necessarily concerned with that, with all of the stuff that happened before she left. But I will say that it's not that he doesn't think that it's entirely irrelevant, because one of the things he really wants to know is who were the three guys at the party. And of course that happened before she left. And the reason for that presumably is because if they could have factored into her disappearance, well, then it's relevant. But until there's like any evidence to suggest that anything before she left UMass impacted what happened to her in New Hampshire, I think he doesn't see why he necessarily has to spend a bunch of time on that. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense, especially when what you know is that there was a car accident right there. You know, what does who she went out with 2 nights before, or what does any of that have to do with the fact that she got in an accident and what separated her from her car and what happened thereafter? It makes perfect sense to me. And it also makes perfect sense to me that now that we, you know, so many years later, we're trying to figure out if any of it does have anything to do with it. And people are backtracking. And when you're looking at victimology, of course, you look at anything that might cause someone to, you know, have been the victim of a crime if that occurred here. So I get why people are doing it, but I don't get why people are reading negatively into why Fred said that, because if that was my kid, Ooh, it almost makes me want to start crying. If that was my child, I would want to shake everybody and say, I don't care. That doesn't matter. We're looking for my child. Can we just look? Can we get more people out here? Can we, you know? So I completely understand it from an emotional perspective why he would say that. And that's, you know, I think it's another thing that's sort of really unfair as far as Fred goes. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, bring it up and see what he had, you know, you had discussed with him about that.
I also think, just like, this is my impression, but when I read things like the press release from June of 2004, and I see like what kinds of things that they're focusing on, I mean, it's all about, you know, the note that was found, the sort of implied that it was a suicide note. It was about her emotional state. It was about the fact that she had broken down, quote, broken down at work. They mentioned the personal issues with her boyfriend. Like, it was all these things that he has to fight against, that he knows don't matter. But the police don't necessarily know that, and they don't really have much else to go on. So that's what keeps getting put out there in the media over and over again. So I think it's possible that it might have been somewhat of a reaction to that, because like that's what the narrative was. And he wants to focus it on Haverhill and not on, you know, things that were probably irrelevant.
Right. And I understand that. I agree, because I think that you can't take away the fact that she got in an accident. I understand that there are theories out there that people are thinking, I mean, there's everything from the accident was staged for, you know, God knows there's a million reasons. There's, you know, she was traveling with someone else. There's a whole lot of stuff that people are factoring in, but we can't remove the notion that Fred saw an accident, saw his daughter wasn't there, and what he's wanting to do is take it from that moment. Okay, where did she go? Who grabbed her? What happened? So it's completely reasonable. His reaction is completely reasonable. I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another thing that comes up a lot, and you know, I guess it came up when the author started digging into Mara's life. And I'm not going to say that there's no value in looking at things that happened months and stuff prior, because I absolutely think there is. Like I said, victimology means you want to look back at everything that has happened that you know, to someone that would have landed them in the situation they are now, people they associated with, things that they did, anything. But sometimes we look at them in the wrong way, or we're all looking at these things in different ways. And a bit of information is only as good as the perspective that you're putting on it and what your spin is. And, you know, everybody has a different spin. So I wanted to talk about the stolen credit card thing, because the timing is significant. It was only 3 months prior to her going missing. And, you know, she used it for food. Okay, so what I thought of when I first heard that was, I wondered what her financial situation was like. So she's got two part-time jobs. She couldn't have been making all that much. I mean, you know, and she's got a full-time schedule, you know, two jobs, school. And I can see this as a pressure point for her. You know, I quit college because I couldn't work full-time. I had to work full-time, and I couldn't handle both loads. I couldn't do it. So I can absolutely see this as a pressure point. But I wondered, you know, as far as maybe why she needed to take a break, you know, things were coming to a head, who knows. But as far as the financial situation and all that, what are your thoughts on that? You know, why she, not necessarily, we can't know why she did it, but I just wanted to know, I guess, your thoughts on the credit card thing, it related to food, and if it could have been a pressure point in her life, the financial situation.
To me, I don't necessarily think that it was a function of her being like financially insecure. And or especially food insecure. I know that anyone who lived in the UMass dorms had to also have a meal plan. So she would have had a meal plan for sure. I don't think that it was because she couldn't afford, you know, food or sustenance.
What's a meal plan?
So at least at UMass, the university had, I think, 4 or 5 dining halls around campus. And you had to, if you lived in the dorms, you had to purchase a meal plan. And some were unlimited, meaning that you could go into the dining hall at any time, as many times as you want, and all day, every day. Or the like cheaper ones were 2 or 3 meals a day. Basically, you could go in, swipe your card a limited number of times each day. So either way, I mean, one might be like less convenient, but you weren't going to starve.
Okay.
You're going to be okay in that sense. So I do know that, and Julia said that Maura would never want to ask for money from Fred.
Yeah.
So I do think that it, you know, finances were probably somewhat of a stressor. But in this particular case, I tend to think that it was probably more related to, you know, there's rumors that she had an eating disorder and had been bulimic in the past. And I think that it's probably most likely that her using that credit card was maybe a function of her eating disorder flaring up.
Okay. That makes sense.
Which in the early 2000s, I mean, by the way, like it was, I think when I hear all these people talk about eating disorders and what that means and what it means for her psychology and all this stuff, like people have to understand in the early 2000s, distance runners, it was rampant. A lot of people were affected by it. Certainly, you know, stealing a credit card number to engage in that kind of behavior is a little bit abnormal. I'm not excusing it, but I do think that whatever that compulsion was probably related to her issues there.
Well, I appreciate that because I wasn't sure what that was about. And it's funny that you should say that because I was just watching the newest season of The Crown and they were going into Princess Diana's eating disorder. So, you know, a lot of times it has to do with, you know, anxiety and it has to do with control. There's, you know, anyone can go and do the research on eating disorders. You know, that's a whole different topic, but it absolutely, when you look at people that are in sports and things like that, I know that it was rampant. I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty much common knowledge. I just,
yeah,
you know, so that does shed a little bit more light and about the credit card thing. And then I can see why, you know, you'd come to that conclusion because it's something you could do from your room. Nobody's really watching you. You know what I mean? So if it's something you are ashamed at or embarrassed about, that's how it would sort of play out. So that makes sense.